Session number 6229, reel 2.
This is Collie, reel 2.
Yeah. Well, we were being very constantly bombed at Changi by then. Mostly personnel, anti-personnel bombs. I don't know if you know about these, but they're not very large bombs, but they explode on impact and send shrapnel over a very wide range. And they don't go much into the earth, but they explode on impact and the shrapnel flies in all directions and does the maximum damage to any people who are about. And we got a lot of those. And they were whizzing about. We went down. We did have a shelter. Well, it was a place under the... Our houses were built up on stilts, as it were, not, you know, pillars. And underneath was a place where we could run the car. And also, they put a few sandbags into a place we used as a sort of cellar. And that meant that the whole of the bungalow was over our head, which was pretty thick because it was built of concrete, and these pillars. And with a few sandbags, it was reasonably secure. And that was prepared for us, but I can only remember using it once, and that was when we had some visitors called on us, and there was a raid while they were there, and in deference to them, we took them down into the shelter, and there were some bombs dropped at that time. They were pretty near, and we were all right. And then the next time it happened, well, at least once more, it was getting pretty near us, and we thought we ought to go down. But by that time, they were flying pretty badly outside our place. And we just dodged under the stairs, where there was a cupboard under the stairs, and it just took us. But unfortunately, my husband went to the front door before he came to this understair cupboard. And as he turned to come back in, he caught a bit of shrapnel in the back. So after the raid was over, we wedged him up with towels and he went off to the hospital. And he was very lucky because he had a piece of shrapnel only about an inch from his spine. Well, they kept him in for a few days, so I was there alone in this very isolated quarter. There were only four quarters on a hill, and I was the top one, and all the other people had gone. And I remember during those few days I was alone, there was a noise out on the drive. I could hear something heavy coming up on the drive, and there was a squadron of soldiers bringing a gun, a small gun, and there was a major in charge of this party. And I looked out of the window to see what was going on, and he looked up and saw me and said, "Good God, a woman. Oh, you poor thing. You poor thing," which was very reassuring. So then he said, "Well, we're going to put this gun on your lawn. I hope you won't mind. We'll try not to spoil your flower beds." At that point, with bombs dropping all around us, I thought it was really, oh dear, so beautifully absurd to be bothering about my flower bed, which only had a few canners in anyhow, with this gun. They would avoid my flower bed. And anyway, then a friend of mine who knew I was alone, his family had gone, and he realised that my husband was in hospital, and he came rushing round and said, "You can't stay here alone. You must come round." So then I spent that night in his... He had quite a good shelter, and we stayed there, and that's when this 16-inch gun was pounding all night. And then the next day, when I went back to my quarter, my friend from the mental hospital came flying over, and she said, "I mustn't stay here. It's ridiculous. They're going to bomb this place to bits. You must come back with me." She was at the mental hospital, and her idea was that the Japs would at least honour the Red Cross, which they'd got painted all over the place and put on the lawns and so on. She said, "At least you'll be safe there." And so I did just that. And I stayed with her just for 2 or 3 days. And then my husband came out of hospital and he came to fetch me eventually and said, "Come on, you're getting out." And I'd got this one suitcase. But of course, by then, it was Thursday the 12th, mind you, as I say, and we were bombed all the way to the port In fact, we had to stop the car and get out and shelter, you know, at one point. And we eventually got down to the harbour, and the place was milling with people. And they were just pushing it onto these small boats, as many as they could on each of these small boats that were in the harbour. And I'd got this huge case, never thinking that it would come to the point when I would have to carry it, but it was 28-inch case in buffalo hide with an expanding lid. You can imagine, I couldn't lift the thing. But however, they threw it onto the little boat, and they wouldn't allow my husband in any further than the harbour gates. And so that was that. And we just settled in on this very small boat. And that night, after dark, we set sail.
Yes. And what sort of people were being evacuated at this stage?
Well, just the last minute people. There were quite a number. Well, I don't know. It depends what I call them. Quite a number, I suppose. But there were some of the sailors that had been in hospital left over from the Prince of Wales and the Renown. And they were useless. There was no good keeping sailors in Singapore because there were no ships. So they were pushing them out because they might get back to England and be of use. So they were pushing out people who were no longer any use at all in the defence of Singapore and getting rid of those because they could be of use elsewhere. So there were odd naval personnel on the boat and last-minute people from headquarters and people who no longer could serve any useful purpose in there, and all the women who had been left behind. And unfortunately, among them were some children who should have gone ages before, weeks before, because they'd all had an opportunity to go. There was no reason why children should have been left behind. And then, of course, odd people were pushing their way on. So there were also some Chinese. And I remember there was a Chinese man. How on earth, what on earth he was doing there? And there were all sorts. There were odd Eurasians and people, you know, obviously who were afraid and somehow had got themselves onto the boat. There was a real mixture in the end, and some Australians, and they were, of course, they should have been staying behind, but, you know, they were trying to get away. And it was just a mixed bag altogether. Mm. But mostly they were the people who just, you know, the residue like myself and some, and of course the nurses, because they tried to get out as many nurses as they could, and all these Australian nurses, they pushed them out and so on. Mostly they had to give an order to them because the nurses, the military nurses, refused to go. They said that there was enough for them to do, but they didn't want extra women. They felt that they should go, so they really ordered them out in the end. And so these were the sort of people who'd been left behind, who went because they'd been left behind.
And you were put aboard a ship called the Matahari.
Matahari, yes.
What kind of ship was that?
Well, I think it was a coaster. I'm very vague about it, but I think it must have been a coaster, you know, that just did trading round the coasts. And there were all sorts and conditions and sizes. Well, I think we embarked about 350, and then we took on some more out of the water later on from the people who'd been bombed, and we grabbed them out of the water later on. And so, you know, there were over 400 of us squeezed onto this very small coastal vessel.
What were conditions like aboard that ship?
Well, of course, it was it really was indescribable. It was almost standing room only, as it were, because there just wasn't any room for any movement. You just sort of found a place to sit and stayed in it. And if you found a place to sit and stretch your legs out in front of you, that was as much as you could do. There were a few cabins, but it was which had belonged to the crew, I suppose. But they did push me and the woman I knew who'd been left behind in Fort Canning into this cabin. But it was worse down there than on deck.
Why?
Well, it was so stifling. You see, the Singapore, and there was no air conditioning, and it was smelly and awful down below. But we did sleep down there, this woman and myself, but we had to keep our... They'd given us out Mae West life belts, you know, the sort of thing, don't you, blown up and tied around the back. And they told us to keep those on night and day, so everybody had got those on night and day. And we just sort of dozed when we could and sat about, and of course the food was whatever they'd got, tinned food mostly, and they opened tins and packets of cereal, which they seem to have had, and ship's biscuits, those very hard biscuits, very much like big dog biscuits. Mm. They tasted like dog biscuits. But however, you know, in a way, I think it was such a traumatic experience that nobody was very interested in food. Food didn't really matter very much. After all, you know, among all the things that had happened, food didn't seem to matter at all.
Yes. Now, practically the whole of that convoy was destroyed.
Yes, there were 35 little ships of various sizes set off at that night. I mean, apart from what went other nights, but that night. And only three were undamaged after it. Mm. So I was very, very lucky to be on one of the three.
Mm. And you were aboard that ship for 4 days while the others were going down around you.
Yes.
That must have been a horrific journey.
Oh, it was terrible. And we were bombed ourselves. I think they must have, I don't know what, they 9 planes went over and they each dropped 6 bombs around us. It's a very nasty feeling, bombs falling in the water around you, because it lifts the ship up, you know, with the vibration. And we were being sort of jerked up and down in the ship. It was a very odd feeling. But either they were bad marksmen or what happened, I don't know. But they missed us, so we were very fortunate there. And it may have been, I don't know, it may have been that although there was a gun, an anti-aircraft gun mounted at the back of this boat, the captain refused to use it. And we did hear afterwards that a lot of these small vessels had a gun mounted, and they did take action, and they were immediately bombed and sunk. So whether, because our captain had enough good sense to realise that this one little anti-aircraft gun wasn't going to get us very far, and he didn't draw attention to ourselves like that, perhaps that saved us.
Meanwhile, you were the spectators of the destruction of the rest of the convoy.
Well, we didn't. I can't say that we actually saw the other ships, but of course we did see the people in the water eventually, because they were swimming. Those of them who hadn't lost their lives were swimming, obviously, to be picked up, and we looked over and saw heads bobbing about in the water. I never actually saw myself a ship going down, whether we weren't looking at the time or what, probably flat on our faces somewhere. I couldn't honestly say that I saw any of the ships going down, but of course we were soon aware of it because of the people in the water.
Did you pick many up?
Well, we picked up about 100 and something, 143 or something up, yes.
Were a lot of them injured?
I don't really remember. I wasn't aware of it. I think those who we picked up were the strong swimmers who'd managed to make it as far as the ship, because wasn't aware that they were.
Tell me about the eventual fate of the Mata Hari.
Which day was it? The Friday, I suppose. Yes. I suppose it was the Thursday. No, Friday we were bombed and missed. Saturday it must have been. A destroyer came up alongside, and the captain saw her coming, and he knew that he had no hope against the guns on a Japanese destroyer. And they fired a salvo over the bows, and which apparently is the signal to heave to, or whatever it's called. And so he stopped the engines, and they sent a boarding party from the destroyer and boarded us. But I remarked upon it that they were very polite to the captain, very polite to him, and he took them to his cabin. While he was doing so, he must have given orders to the crew, but while he was entertaining this boarding party, the crew were busily throwing overboard everything that could possibly be of any use or interest, code books, sextants, everything that could possibly in any way be used by the Japs was heaved overboard. And they were busily doing this while the captain entertained the boarding party. And we did the same. Among the things Among the things that went were £80,000 worth of Singapore guilders, I think, which we wished that we'd had, but they thought they didn't want this money to fall into the Japs' hands.
Okay, carry on.
I had a camera, a very good camera, and I thought that that would be of use to them. You know, I think at the moment we felt we didn't want to help them in any way, so I threw over my camera, and I stood and tore up our passports. I had the two passports, my husband's and mine, and I tore them up into shreds and threw them overboard, because I had this idea in my mind that the Japs, being cunning, would be able to use them and alter the photographs and have British passports in their hands. So I thought my duty was to destroy these passports, which I did solemnly, and threw those overboard. And as I say, it was a sort of bit of a frenzy, because we didn't know what was in front of us then. All we knew was that there they were, and what was going to happen to us, we just didn't know. And so that was it. Then they took us, they told the captain to sail into the nearest port, or which must have been the nearest, I suppose, which was Muntok, the island of Muntok. And
so this was Banka Island, wasn't it?
Yes.
Banka.
Well, in the Banka Straits. You know, the name of the island is Muntok, but it's in the Banka Straits. Uh-huh. And the straits are called Banka, but the island was Muntok. And unless that was the name of the town, I don't know. Perhaps it was the name of the town on the island.
I'll check that. I think the name of the town was Muntok,
well,
and the island was called Banka.
Yes, it might have been. Mm. We always spoke of it as Muntok. And they disembarked us there, and it was in the evening, and they just left us all night on the jetty. They just took us to the jetty, disembarked us, and we just stayed there. They told us when we left the Matahari to take what we could carry only. Now, I told you I couldn't carry this suitcase. I couldn't lift it. Somebody had put it on the Matahari for me, but I couldn't lift it. And I thought, well, if we were going to have to carry it anywhere, I just was incapable of carrying it. Adding to that, I suffer from migraine, and unfortunately I had a migraine. So I wasn't in any fit state to really know very much what I was doing. So I had a hat box with me, as well as this suitcase. Now, a hat box in my life wasn't for hats. It was for small things that nowadays you'd put in a sort of a smaller case. But they weren't made in those days, the small ones. And so I always used a hat box as a small case, a weekend case, as it were. And so I packed in there everything I could think of that would go in, which wasn't very much.
What sort of things did you select?
Well, if it won't embarrass you, the first thing that was in my mind was that I had had a period start that morning, which accounted for the migraine. And I could only think of sanitary towels. So half the case was packed with sanitary towels, which, of course, was the most foolish thing, because it took up valuable space. I mean, the length of their life was so short, and I left behind so many things that would have lasted me for years. But you see, you make these decisions on the spur of the moment. My need at the moment was in my mind. And I put a spare pair of shoes in. I put an extra dress in. Two extra dresses, I think. I was dressed in shorts. I had some golf shorts I was wearing on the board. They were made of terralin sort of material, and they were quite full and pleated, and a blouse. I was wearing that, so I kept that. That was all right. And I put in, as far as I can remember, two dresses, a pair of shoes, a pair of slippers for some reason, and all sorts of quite idiotic things. As I say, I had a migraine, and if you've ever suffered from migraine, you really are not in any fit state to think coherently. And so I really wasn't very aware what I was doing. I was just pushing things in, and I couldn't have cared less what I was leaving behind. I cared a lot once I realised what valuable stuff I'd left behind, but I couldn't at the moment. I think I put in a bar of soap or odd things like that. And that was all, and I had a travelling coat, a tweed travelling coat, which I put over my arm, and a travelling rug. And that was all I could manage, more than I could manage, really. And that's what we were landed on, this jetty, and we stayed there all night. And
I notice in your memoir of that period, you You refer to the appalling first night on the jetty. Why was it appalling?
Well, because, I mean, you imagine just on a jetty, on a stone jetty. There was nowhere to sit except on the stone. There were no toilet facilities. All we could do, there were some steps leading down from the jetty, which was, of course, going down to landing onto small boats, and we could only go down there and use the water for toilets. That's all we could do. And there were all of us, 200 or 300 of us there, just sitting there on the end of a jetty all night. And the worst of it was not knowing what was ahead of us. We had no idea. And we could smell bodies being burnt. We could smell burning flesh. And again, that's not exactly contributory to a restful night, because we didn't know. We thought they might take us on and machine gun the lot of us. We didn't know at all what we were facing. And these awful conditions, just, as I say, just a stone jetty with hundreds of us huddled there. And the Jap soldiers were just wandering round and frightening people with their bayonets fixed and so on. You know, it was really quite terrifying. And as I say, this smell of burning flesh, which I can always remember all my life, I think, this smell, they must, I think, because they had already landed on Muntok or Banker Island, and there had been a lot of dead, and I think they were probably doing the best thing they could in that temperature to get rid of the bodies. But we had no idea at the time why there was such a strong smell of burning flesh. We just no idea. We didn't realise that it was probably just because of the onslaught that had been made in the island that they there were a lot of dead lying about. I suppose it was the best way to dispose of them.
And how did this night finally, once this night had finally ended, what happened to you subsequently?
Well, then we had to trail along this jetty. It seemed interminable. I don't know how long it was. It seemed so long without carrying what we'd got. And again, as I say, not knowing what we're facing us. But they took us to this sort of meeting place to weed us out, and standing about in the sun and so on. By that time it was Sunday, and we passed, lying in the sun, stretchers with wounded men on them, just left lying in the sun. It was, you know, it broke our hearts, and yet we couldn't do anything. There were wounded men, our wounded soldiers there, lying in the sun on stretchers. But they did tell us that Singapore had fallen. That's how we found out Singapore's fallen. And again, we couldn't really believe that this had happened so soon after we left. And
they took you to a centre where they weeded you out. What kind of weeding went on?
I'm very vague about this. I think I was vague altogether there.
Never mind. You described again in your memoir the walk to Muntok you described as a nightmare.
Mm.
Why was that?
Well, partly because we were tired. We'd had no sleep that night. I mean, after all, when you're suddenly taken prisoner by enemies, but you've no idea what treatment is there, you've had a sleepless night besides a traumatic day, and you're tired by dragging along, because although my coat and my rug came in very useful, it wasn't very good to be carrying this weighty and warm stuff in the heat, tropical heat. And we were very tired by then, and having seen these soldiers and dispirited with the news that Singapore had fallen. And I think a nightmare describes it very well.
Mm. Were you still all together as you had come ashore onto the jetty, or had you been divided?
No, we were still all together. They even took the men to these coolie lines.
Yes, where were you taken?
Well, they were coolie lines. They must have been used, I don't, for the coolies for some purpose. I don't know, but they were just coolie lines. There was a shelter over the whole thing. Corrugated iron shelter, I think it was. And then there were dormitories leading off a main hall, as it were. Maybe the main part had been used for selling stuff. It might have been some sort of market or fish, selling fish or something. I don't know. We never found out. But there were these dormitories on either side, and they were sloping like fish slabs in the fish shops, you know. I suppose the coolies must have slept on the... Why they had to sleep on sloping ones, I don't know, except that it was easier to wash them down, I suppose, afterwards. And they were concrete, and we were just pushed into these, so many, about 40, I think, in each of these dormitory places. And we just made the best of it and threw our things down and sat down and eventually lay down somehow. And there we stayed in there for a fortnight before they moved us again. And the men were there then, you see. They put the men on one side and the women on the other. They had divided them up because, I say, there were some men. And apart from the ones we'd originally started with, there were those we'd picked up. So they divided us up. But there was a concourse where we could meet during the day.
I see. Did the Japanese divided you so that women went into some dormitories, men in the others?
Yes,
this wasn't something you
did
yourself?
No, they did it. No, they did it.
I see. Yes. Whereabouts was this area? I mean, was it in the town, in the country?
I couldn't tell you. I think it seemed to be in the town. As I say, the walking business seemed a very long way to me then, but whether it was a long way, I think it couldn't have been miles. So it must have been, I think, in the town.
Right. When you arrived at the at the coolie lines, what was the sort of role that the Japanese played in your reception and your organisation?
They didn't seem to do anything, having provided us, as they thought, with a place to sleep, with a roof over our heads, and threw in some rice to be cooked and the means of cooking it. They rather left us to our own devices. There were always sentries about with the fixed bayonets, so that we couldn't escape, but they didn't do anything about organising it at all. There was no sort of organisation. We organised what we could ourselves, and some of our nurses went over to the men's lines to see what they could do for these wounded soldiers, but of course there was very little they could do. There weren't any medical supplies. But some of them were very badly wounded, and the Japs at that point were, you know, pretty nasty to them, and there were many incidents that are best forgotten. But I think, of course, this was the soldier. These were soldiers. And I suppose to them, suddenly having white people, they were getting a bit uppity about it. They were rather overdoing things. And they were in a position where they could throw their weight about, and they did.
In what sort of ways did they throw their weight around?
Well, mostly with the men more than with us. They, as I say, they walked in and out of our dormitories, of course, but with the men there was a lot of, you know, shouting and pushing bayonets at you and so on. But we weren't terribly aware of them on our side. As I say, they kept walking through our dormitories at night and flashing flashlights all over us when we just managing to get a bit of sleep. They'd come through and throw flashlights at us. I think more curiosity. I can't think that it was necessary, probably to just be curious.
I've asked you about your arrival at the camp. Do you recall what your first impressions of this place were, what your strongest reactions to it were?
Well, I think it was mixed. I think partly relief that at least we were all together. They'd left the men in with us. We didn't know how long that would last, but, I mean, it was a relief to think that our men were there. And that there was a place, there was a shelter, and there was somewhere to rest for a little while anyway. And we could take a breath before we had to meet whatever else was to come. I think it was a bit of a breathing space in a way. And as I say, you know, an experience like that does leave you a bit numbed. I think I don't know, perhaps I reacted that way. I do incline to numb when there's an experience. I just numb. It's rather a good way of getting over it, actually, you know, just not to feel anything. Mm. Certainly there was no hysteria anywhere. I think everybody was taking it. And, of course, we were terribly worried about people coming in, because for days after we got there, people were coming in who had been brought out of the sea, because the shipwrecked people were still coming in after 4 or 5 days, because some of them were in the water 4 or 5 days on rafts and so on, and they were coming in all the time, and they needed attention, because now a lot of those, the women, had got very bad rope burns on their hands and on their legs and so on, where they'd slid down ropes to get into the sea, and not being used to ropes, and of course in a panic probably, they'd slipped down the ropes into the sea, and inconsequent friction burns had burnt their hands, and there they were with hands terribly burnt, couldn't even hold a spoon to feed themselves and so on. And of course they were in tatters and in dire need of rest and attention and so on, and we were quite taken up with them and feeling very fortunate ourselves, those of us who had escaped the water. And as I say, I think, looking back, it's very difficult to look back after all this time. I think in a way I did regard it more or less as a slight breathing space before we had to meet whatever else was coming.